someone phoned me and said, did you know that a crew member of the Sophia is still alive? And I said, can't be. They're all dead. He said, true, but this guy crewed not on that voyage, but on an earlier one. I said, he must be a million years old. No, he's 95. And he lived in a senior's house right across the street from the house I was renting. It was a old motel turned into a senior's home. So I phoned the home and I said, will this guy talk to me? And they said, oh, yeah, he's alert. He's 95. His name is Philip A. Hole. I thought, if my name was Hole, I would not give my son a name that had the initial A. But, of course, this was a different time. He was born in 1893, and he'd been the purser on the Sophia in 1916. So I went across the street, went up to his room, couldn't have had much money. It was a small room, like a motel room with two beds in it, and this other guy had the TV on. I talked to him, and he was alert, and I thought, you know, this is a living link with the thing. I couldn't believe my eyes that I was talking to him. And all I remember, he didn't have much stamina, but so we went out in the hall because the other guy was watching The Price is Right. And I said to him, how did they navigate in the dark? Because you're coming down the Lynn Canal in 1916. You don't have radar. They had radio, but they didn't have radar. I said, how did you navigate? How did you keep from running into Vanderbilt Reef every time you went down? And he said, what we did was blow the whistle or the ship's horn and then listen for the echoes off the steep sides of the canal. And I still remember this frail old man shifting from left foot to right foot, 1001, 1002, 1003, then it would go boom, boom, and they knew they were in the middle. And I said, well, what did they do when it was screaming wind and snowing? And he didn't have any answer for that, unfortunately, because, of course, that was what it was like when the ship hit the reef. But I thought that was really cool. 95 years old.
Has anything new come to light since yourself and Mr. Coates wrote the...
I don't think so. Not that I know of. The people who wrote the book several years later went over the same ground. They concentrated on whether, I think it was called, could they have been saved? Well, the answer is sure, some of them could have been saved. If your listeners who have been to Vanderbilt Reef will know, in heavy weather, lowering a lifeboat onto a flat reef with a foot or two of water or 2 or 3 feet, and it's choppy, lowering a lifeboat onto it is pretty dangerous. And the captain thought, let's wait until it gets calm. Well, it didn't get calm, and that's what sank the ship. The day after the sinking, it was flat calm, and you could have got them all off without a single loss of life. So, yeah, they could have been saved, but as the Commission of Inquiry decided, his actions were not unreasonable.
One of the things that struck me, the connections that a lot of the people had all up and down this coast. And
yes.
It seems the boundaries, the distinctions between what was American territory, what was Canada, were a lot more diffuse and blurred then. And there were people that kind of made their way all up and down from Ketchikan up to the interior of Alaska.
You must have looked at the notes for my talk. Have you been searching my briefcase?
No, but I did read your book.
No, well, that's great. And it's true. I mean, until they built the Alaska Railroad in the 20s, by far the best way to get south from Fairbanks and the interior of Alaska was to go up the Yukon River through Dawson and then further up to Whitehorse, get on the train, catch one of the ships and come down south. And people did that. And what we discovered in researching for the book were that there were people who had done that every year since the gold rush. They had been working in the north on the river or in the mines or in the dredges for 15 or 20 years, and they'd never spent a winter in the north. They'd always wintered in Portland or Seattle or Vancouver or wherever. There was a huge out-migration. They were totally interconnected. You know, they'd meet each other. Hi, Fred. This is a guy from Tanana, and he meets his buddy in Dawson City, and they get on the steamship together, and et cetera. So it was a very multinational event.
You tell me a little bit about the impact, though, on the interior Alaska and also the Yukon community when all those lives were lost.
You know, the subtitle of the book is called Taking the North Down With Her, The Sinking of the Princess Sophia. And we wanted to prove that it dealt a devastating blow, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, looking back on it, I don't think it really had very much effect, certainly not on the Yukon. The Yukon's population in 1918 was only just over 4,000, of whom 1,500 were indigenous people. So there were 2,500 outsiders there, and they didn't by any means all stay the winter. What eviscerated the Yukon was not the death of the mining economy, but the death of the hands-on mining economy and the coming of the dredges, which weren't very labor-intensive, and the First World War. The Yukon had the highest rate of enlistment per capita of any place in Canada for the military in the First World War. Awful lot of the young men left. And I think that's what did them in.